This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Great Smoky Mountains National Park is one of 9 national parks in eastern part of this country. Compare that with 49 national parks in the west. Of course, we're all grateful to have these protected lands that conserve a healthy environment and provide lots of space for recreation. But in fact, most of the managed wilderness in the U.S. is not national parkland, but national forest. In North Carolina, we have 4 of them, the Pisgah, the Croatan, Uwharrie, and the Nantahala. And together, they are more than twice the size of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and that's 1 million acres. The history of our national parks is well known, not without controversy, and particularly that controversy comes with those people displaced by their creation. But the history of our national forests is less well known, far more complicated, and arguably far more important. Kathy Newfont believes that this understanding of the history of the Southern Appalachians is the best way to understand the national forests in America. Her new book is called Blue Ridge Commons, Environmental Activism and the Forest History in Western North Carolina. And Kathy Newfont is my guest on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So tell us the difference now between national parks, national forests, and national wilderness.
Right. These are complicated and not widely understood by the American public that owns them all. The national parks were founded on a preservationist model, so that the idea is really to protect the lands. National forests were founded on a conservationist model. In other words, that they were founded as production grounds. The idea was to have a sustainable flow of timber. Timber was the overriding concern when they were created. But since then, there's also been a lot of interest in wildlife, in water quality, and having those lands serve those needs as well. And then the federal wilderness system, although it existed in sort of piecemeal fashion earlier, was actually created in 1964 by the Wilderness Act. And there are lands within national forests that are part of the wilderness system. Here in North Carolina, only a tiny fraction of our national forest lands are actually part of the federal wilderness system. Most of the land is managed for what the Forest Service calls multiple use, which means not only recreation and preservation of certain areas that which wilderness emphasizes, but also timber production, wildlife support, and a host of other uses.
So, if we have these two initial, distinctions, a place to just save stuff so it doesn't all get developed, national parks,
right,
and then national forests. Well, we want to develop, we want to use this stuff, but if we're not careful about how we do it, we're going to lose it all too quickly. National forests, production. Why do we need the wilderness distinction within those forests?
The Forest Service began creating what some of them were called primitive areas. Within the Forest Service, even in the early days, they recognized that some of the lands had particular value. For instance, in Western North Carolina, we are celebrating right now about 100 years of actually having national forests in the East. In Western North Carolina, the Joyce Kilmer area is one that some of your listeners may be familiar with, where the forest was never harvested, so that some of the ancient trees are still there. And early on, the Forest Service designated that as a primitive area. And later, Joyce Kilmer was added after the Wilderness Act. Joyce Kilmer became part of the federal wilderness system. And the existence of that wilderness system has to do with Americans wish to protect more of the lands because the vast majority of our public lands are in the national forest system as opposed to the national park system. And there was a concern that too many of those lands were being used for basically industrial development.
So it protects. It gives it greater protection.
That's right. The wilderness system offers protection to lands within the Forest Service and other federal landholding agencies that otherwise might not protect them.
Without making it a park, which would give access to everybody. And I think in the wilderness areas, too, isn't there concern that we really even don't want to give access to people who might go to a park? Get
more
your cars out, even the hikers. We want to really keep them out of this area.
Wilderness is heavily used, but it's it is, there is an effort to limit, like not driving cars into a wilderness, for instance, although you can do that in the national parks, of course. Right. And so that there is an effort to limit their use. And one of the difficulties with wilderness actually is how heavily used it really is.
Well, let's talk about national parks, because I think we're most familiar with those. We think of Teddy Roosevelt right away, if you know anything about the parks. Give us a bit of their history, how they came about.
Well, in North Carolina, the national parks actually came after the national forests. In fact, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park was originally, that track was originally slated to be part of the National Forest System, but the Forest Service essentially gave up on acquiring the land because the title records were so knotty and confused that it was very difficult to get clear title. The Forest Service bought lands from willing sellers, and so they had to have clear title to the lands in order to be able to buy them. They did not, in other words, use the federal government's power of eminent domain to condemn lands. Rather, they let people know that they were interested in purchasing lands and then took offers. In the Great Smoky Mountains Purchase Unit, as it was called originally when the Forest Service was interested, they ran into legal entanglements so impossible that they had to give up and move out. And yet that area was one that a lot of people really valued for its majestic beauty. And it was very much threatened by timber harvesting and development in that area. And so a kind of a renewed effort to protect those lands led to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park that we have today.
And in your book, you describe what you call commons environmental activism, and you compare that with wilderness environmental activism. And I'd like you to distinguish those two things.
Yes. The book started with an interview that I did while I was a student at UNC Chapel Hill. I was working with the Southern Oral History Program in their Women's Leadership and Grassroots Activism Project. And as a graduate student working on that project, I was assigned to interview women who'd been active in the conservation and environmental movement. And so Esther Cunningham, who founded the Western North Carolina Alliance, which is featured on the cover of the book, and she came up very early on as someone I needed to interview. So I went and interviewed Esther at her home outside of Franklin, and that interview just stuck because she talked about the forests in ways that I found fascinating, but that I could not quite understand. I couldn't quite put my finger on what was different about Esther. And this book, Blue Ridge Commons, is my multi-year effort to make sense of that. And that term, commons environmentalism, is a term I've given to the kind of environmentalism that she practiced and that other mountain people practiced in their forest defense efforts. It comes out of a different relationship to the land than a wilderness environmentalism. A commons is a shared harvest ground. So there's an emphasis on harvesting. And of course, in the mountains, there's a long history of harvesting lots of products from those incredible woodlands. And but the mountain people defended forests from industrial development from this commons model. In the wilderness battles of the 1970s, for instance, there was a lot of opposition to new federally designated wilderness that was proposed in the late 1970s. And I argue that that opposition grew out of the fear that wilderness would remove lands from commons use. In other words, that you would not, there was a misconception about wilderness. You actually can hunt and fish in designated wilderness areas, but wilderness opponents made sure that that was kind of muddy water. And
well, let me ask you right now, if that was a kind of hangover from when the national park system was developed here in the East and mountain people were thrown off the land, again, not wilderness land where we're buying from willing sellers, using eminent domain to throw people off the land.
That's
oh,
right.
No, here they come again.
That's exactly right, Frank. That was the fear that the insatiable urban public was demanding more land for its exclusive use. That was the understanding that a lot of people had, because there in the mountains, people are much more likely, or certainly were at the times of those wilderness debates, to be hunters, to be fishing, to have traditions in which they gathered berries in the woods or dug ginseng, not so much recreational hikers and backpackers. And so their feeling was that this land was threatened with enclosure, which is essentially privatization, taking lands that were available for common use and reserving them for the exclusive use of a few, a privileged few, typically at the expense of the ordinary working many.
Yeah, so it's an interesting split when you think about that kind of environmentalism that does honor a concept of the commons, that is, we all share this in common, and is nervous about industrial use as it is about recreational use.
That's precisely it. In fact, the same people often who had opposed the designation of wilderness often turned around and then opposed petroleum development in the national forest and opposed clear cutting in the national forest. And even in one case, used wilderness designation as a commons defense tool. So that in the southern Nantahala, which under the wilderness designation efforts of the late 1970s was actually the only entirely new wilderness created in western North Carolina. So an incredible victory, actually, for wilderness advocates. That effort was led by local bear hunters and raccoon hunters who argued that wilderness designation was the best way to protect that very valuable local hunting ground, camping ground, and fishing grounds. And so they defended that wilderness designation on a commons ground.
It's interesting because if we had a better understanding of that commons environmental ethic, it might help us understand how we let leases for timber, for minerals, all of that on public land. It's our land. Those are our trees. Those are our minerals. They're leased to private companies, usually at a discount. And so it's a fairly interesting concept when you think about the commons and what we share and how our share should be parceled out to us.
Exactly. And as an American public, those are decisions that we have to help shape. And this book, the second sort of 40% of the book, focuses on the political debates that came in the wake of the 1976 National Forest Management Act. That act gave the American public for the first time a real voice in the management of national forests. Up to that point, there had been no formal venue, the Forest Service thought of itself as technocrats who knew better than most people how to manage the forest. And citizen input wasn't really something that the Forest Service valued particularly until the National Forest Management Act required it to do so. And as you can imagine, in western North Carolina, where all these people had a long history of working the woods, when given the opportunity to speak out about forest management, they did so and continue to today.
The commons argument was most prominent in wilderness debates in the 1970s. Particularly, you talk about rare evaluations, RARE. Tell us about those.
Yes, that's the RARE stands for Roadless Area Review and Evaluation. And my chapter, the couple of chapters on that process focuses on what's known as RARE 2. There were two rounds of this Roadless Area Review and Evaluation. The second round focused on eastern lands and is really the one that I talk most about in the book. The idea was to evaluate lands held by the National Forest Service and other federal agencies for potential inclusion in the federal wilderness system. And so that was the series of debates that came through. It was the first big forest management question that came before the public in the wake of the National Forest Management Act. So it's the first time that Western North Carolinians and other Americans across the nation had the opportunity to really speak out about forest management decision making. And in Western North Carolina, the region just erupted over the wilderness debates.
And this kind of argument is more well-developed in the East, you argue, because of the way land management happened east and west. Tell us about that, the fact that so many Western lands came under federal protection before anybody owned them.
Precisely. In the West, the federal government owned huge sections of land when the American public first became concerned about conserving some of those lands. It really became concerned about industrial development of those lands. And so the federal government was able to essentially just set aside large sections of the West and not move those sections into private hands. So the government could just draw lines around the parcels it wanted to set aside and then do that. In the East, that wasn't possible because essentially all lands were in private hands. And so if you were going to develop a federally held land base in the East, you had to reacquire the lands. And there are two ways of doing that. One was to draw a line around the lands that you wanted and essentially condemn them, remove everyone who was living there, as happened in the case of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and the Shenandoah and other eastern parks. But the other was to acquire land from willing sellers. And that's what the Forest Service did. It did not condemn those lands, did not remove people. And as a result, we have this crazy patchwork in the East of, if you look at the county level, the forests, the national forests are squiggly, amoeba-like, crazy quilts.
And it leads to these kind of odd, crazy quilts of people who come together over these issues, alliances, about environmentalism and environmental protection. I remember William Ruckelshaus was the first director of the EPA back in the 1970s, appointed by Richard Nixon. He then leaves office. Ronald Reagan comes into office, very heavily criticized for his environmental policies. He gets rid of his old EPA director and brings back William Ruckelshaus, the founder of the EPA. The problem was William Ruckelshaus had since gone on to become the president of, or executive vice president of Weyerhaeuser, which is the largest, you know, timber company in America. And people said, really, Ronald Reagan, you're going to bring back the guy who cuts down trees as the environmental protection agent? And he came back and said, no, we protect trees, what we do. And he made a very good case for the fact that what Weyerhaeuser did was protect land because they needed good land. They needed to plant a lot of trees. It was kind of an interesting environmental argument.
It is an interesting argument, and it has resonance with that commons model, which really values the forest as productive harvest grounds. What's interesting to me is certainly there's been some work done already on hunters and fishermen and how active those constituencies have been in protecting valued hunting grounds and fishing grounds. I don't think we've had a language to talk about that. That's what I'm aiming to establish with this concept of commons environmentalism. I believe actually that there are lots of examples of commons across the nation that can yield these sort of environmentalisms.
And it gets important when we realize, for instance, how a company gets the right to cut down trees. Tell us about that.
Well, and on public lands, on lands that the U.S. Forest Service holds, the Forest Service goes through a bidding process, essentially. A district ranger will decide where a timber sale is to take place and then offer it up for sale. And there's a bidding process that companies go through. One of the issues in Western North Carolina was that increasingly in the period after World War II, timber sales, which had before that time gone to fairly small operators, were going increasingly to very large operators. Another hallmark of common systems is that they support typically a great many small operators. And when larger operators with heavy, it was more capital intensive forms of harvest, big heavy equipment that smaller operators had a harder time affording. So more and more of those contracts were going to big operators. And one of the arguments that people made was that the publicly owned forests, your forest, my forest, were going to rich timbermen. They were the ones that were getting the benefits.
Who were putting little guys out of business and then could afford to buy at a discount. And that discount was costing us because we weren't getting the full value for our minerals.
That's right. The Wilderness Society did a lot of work on below-cost timber sales, and that was a factor across the nation and certainly also in Western North Carolina.
My guest this hour, Kathy Newfont, professor of history for the Ramsey Center for Regional Studies at Mars Hill College and author of the new book, Blue Ridge Commons, Environmental Activism and Forest History in Western North Carolina. And our conversation is going to continue after this break on the State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with Kathy Newfont, Associate Professor of History at Mars Hill College, author of the new book, Blue Ridge Commons, Environmental Activism and Forest History in Western North Carolina. So we've had National Forest in North Carolina for about 100 years now because of the Weeks Act. Tell us about that legislation.
That's right. 1911 was the year that the Weeks Act passed. And in the wake of that act, crews went fanning out across the southern Appalachians, surveying lands for inclusion in the Forest Service system that was being created in the east. The Weeks Act gave the federal government authority to purchase lands in the east. Up to that point, there was some question about whether or not that was constitutional for the federal government to do. And originally, it was kind of interesting the way it came to pass because the act allowed the federal government to purchase lands to control the watersheds of navigable rivers, the headwaters of navigable rivers under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. So it was kind of it was really meant to protect forest resources, but they had to kind of go in a back door to be able to do that. So our forests in Western North Carolina, crews hit the ground almost as soon as the Weeks Act passed in March of 1911, and there were crews fanning out all over the Appalachians surveying lands. It was an immense effort to get these lands from the private domain into federal ownership, and really fascinating. In my research, it took me, among other places, to here in Durham, where the Forest History Society has a wonderful archives, and they have some photographs from that period, from 1912, when these young men were fanned out all over the Appalachians surveying the woods.
It's kind of interesting that there's a Forest History Society in Durham.
That's right. Yeah, it's the headquarters of the National Society. It's a wonderful resource. And Jonathan Keith Esser was the young man who, I guess he just had a camera with him when he was working on one of these survey crews, and he took wonderful photos of the work of the crews.
When we think about the commons and our use and the fact that these in forest lands are our trees, clear-cutting is one of the most controversial issues. Tell us about that.
Yes, clear-cutting is an issue that drew broad criticism. And certainly Western North Carolina erupted in the 1980s in a huge broad-scale critique of clear-cutting. And essentially, some of the same people who had fought against wilderness in just a few years before, sometimes less than a decade before, were also very adamantly opposed to clear-cutting. Clear-cutting is a timber harvest technique in which every tree is cut, regardless of size, regardless of species, regardless of age, regardless of timber quality. And so it leaves a hideous visual. And even the supporters of the technique recognize the ugliness of its aesthetic. And so the Forest Service embraced clear-cutting increasingly after World War II, first in the West, and then beginning in the 1960s, the technique moved to the East. And almost from the moment it was practiced on Appalachian forests, people really came out against it. And the Forest Service and clear-cutting supporters tried to talk about the aesthetic and talk about how this was a way of rejuvenating the forest. I think what they did not fully understand was the power of this commons critique, because a lot of mountain residents were really critical, not only on the visual aesthetic grounds, but also because it essentially destroyed the forest for other uses, at least in the short term. I mean, it would be decades before a fully grown forest would mature. And that meant that, you know, you were potentially losing prime bear hunting grounds. Right. For instance, bears rely on mature stands of oaks and other nut-bearing trees. And
this,
can't survive in clear cuts.
Right. And this brings us to the question of biodiversity, which is now at the center of any critique of sort of wilderness use.
Yes. Biodiversity is something I don't know how many North Carolinians really realize, the incredible richness of the forests here in our own state. There's been some wonderful recent work done on that. And if you'll indulge me, I'll just read a couple of sentences out of the book here. I'm on page 5. Acre for acre, no other temperate region on Earth can surpass the Southern Blue Ridge in biological wealth. A single Blue Ridge Cove may rival all of Europe in the number of tree species it sustains. And beyond trees, it's even more astonishing. The scientists estimate that there may be as many as 100,000 total species in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park alone. And there are species that don't exist in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park that do exist in other places in the Blue Ridge. So let me just give you some numbers that we have as of 2009 through the All Taxa Biodiversity Inventory that was conducted in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Biologists had recorded more than 17,000 species in the park as of 2009, and that included 1,600 vascular plants, 350 ferns and mosses, 240 birds, 100 crustaceans, 75 fishes, 65 mammals, 40 amphibians, and 40 reptiles. And if you get into some of the categories that are a good deal less glamorous, the numbers go even higher than that. 2,700 fungi, 2,400 beetles, 1,000 algae, and that survey in the park, which is still ongoing, but had released data that it collected between 1998 and 2009, and it documented over 6,500 species previously unknown to inhabit the park and over 900 species completely new to science.
And now we're learning that the importance of preserving these is because whole ecosystems that are now very important to the health of the planet, as we've seen from global warming, has deep economic impact. It ain't just saving the owls. So I appreciate all the work you've done. Kathy, so great to talk with you.
It's so great to be with you, Frank.
Kathy Newfont is an associate professor of history and the faculty chair for the Ramsey Center for Regional Studies at Mars Hill College. Her new book is called Blue Ridge Commons, Environmental Activism and Forest History in Western North Carolina. She's going to be signing books today at Bull's Head Bookshop on the campus of UNC Chapel Hill, 2 o'clock, then at McIntyre's Farrington Village, Saturday at 11.